Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. For two decades, Diane Button, an end-of-life doula, has helped people navigate their final days. In her new book, What Matters Most, Lessons the Dying Teach Us About Living, Button shares stories about how the dying can help us learn to live. We'll be talking with Button and taking your questions. And later in the hour, we'll talk to San Francisco-born poet Thea Matthews. She'll tell us about her new collection, Grime, which is rooted in her childhood in the Tenderloin. But first, the rules that safeguard endangered species like the wonderful California sea otter are shifting in Washington, and California isn't waiting to find out what happens next. Last week, Governor Gavin Newsom signed a new law allowing California to fast-track protections for endangered species if and when federal safeguards are weakened. To explain what's at stake, we're joined by Kristen Boyles, managing attorney with Earth Justice. Welcome to State of the Bay, Kristen.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're delighted to have you. And I guess we could start out by explaining what exactly is the Trump administration proposing to do that would weaken the habitat protection under the Endangered Species Act?
Absolutely. And it's really important because the Endangered Species Act makes it illegal to take a threatened or endangered fish or critter or mammal or wildlife once it's protected. And then the question is, well, what does it mean to take a species? What does that mean? And the statute defines it. It means to shoot or to wound or to kill, but it also says to harm the species. And for decades, the understanding, the biological understanding of that has been that to harm a species means to harm its habitat, to significantly harm where it lives, where it nests, where it feeds, in such a way that it would actually harm the species itself. That has been the understanding. That's the biological understanding. That is the legal understanding of what the word harm means in the statute. The Trump administration has proposed to delete and eliminate the definition of harm so that it's in a regulation, so that harm would no longer mean to the harm that prohibited harm is harm to habitat. And it just flies in the face of all sorts of common sense and biological sense, because the habitat needs protecting. You will not have the species if you do not protect its home.
I mean, California sea otters are having a moment thanks to Taylor Swift. She wore a T-shirt with the California sea otters from Monterey Bay Aquarium. I understand that raised $2 million.
I saw that. It's amazing.
For the otters. So when we think about the harm, like taking away a habitat, I mean, in the case of the sea otters, that would mean, you know, suddenly the kelp forests that are already suffering would be endangered, the water around them, the seashore, the coastal areas that they frequent. What does that mean? I mean, they're beloved animals, but what might this idea mean for other types of endangered species?
And you're absolutely right about the sea otters, and the sea otters are a pretty good example to see how ludicrous this idea is, that somehow now harm to habitat doesn't count as prohibited take. Because take the kelp forests. If you have the loss of the kelp forests, the sea otters will have no place to eat, to protect themselves, to sleep, to rest. That is their homes. And if you deprive them of that habitat, even if you haven't, you know, gone out and killed an otter, you have excess. You are going to actually be killing the otter. It's the same thing to think about if you think about species like the marble murrelet, which is a seabird that's found around Monterey Bay that nests exclusively in old growth forests. If you have a timber sale and you are cutting down nesting trees for the marble murrelet, even if the murrelet wasn't in the tree when you cut it down, you will have harmed that species. You will have prevented it from having a place to lay its eggs and rear its young. The examples are almost endless, because every single species needs its habitat to live and survive and recover. And so that's what's being targeted by the Trump administration.
You know, we've heard in the past, you know, people who don't appreciate the Endangered Species Act, they say, you know, it's like we can't have a road because we have to protect this random insect or turtle, or we can't have housing here because now we're worried about this particular bird. I mean, as somebody who works at Earth Justice, which touts itself as nature's law firm. I mean, what do you say to somebody like that who feels that the Endangered Species Act is kind of putting itself in the way of progress?
I think that the facts don't bear that out. There certainly seems to have been a lot of progress in the Bay Area, or up even in Seattle, where I'm sitting right now. The fact is, the Endangered Species Act works incredibly well to both protect species and allow projects to go forward. Projects go forward, but perhaps they go forward in a different, slightly different place. So it's not right in the habitat of a nesting species, or it's a change to the waterways and there's less pollution dumped into a river where endangered or threatened salmon live. The Endangered Species Act is all about taking into account the needs of the other creatures that we live in this world with. And when that happens, you can have both progress defined however people are defining it, and protection of the natural world. And you cannot disregard the fact that we are part of the natural world. And it's the harm that we are doing to species is ultimately harm that we're going to be doing to ourselves.
Yes, exactly. And so, in the wake of a lot of Trump administration rules, regulations, changes to the law, states are trying to take matters into their own hands. And that is exactly what Governor Newsom is trying to do with a new law that will take effect. It was signed last week, October 11th, and will take effect in January 1st, 2026. What is the California law going to do, and how is that going to help endangered species?
Yeah, it's exciting to see states trying to step into this gap that the federal government is creating. AB 1319 does two basic things, is going to try to do two basic things. It's going to get California state protections for species going quicker, so that species can get the protections that the state offers, a faster process for that. And it's also going to create a state backstop for the prosecution of wildlife crimes, and how those crimes are tracked, which right now the federal government does most of that. And so having the state step in should the feds stop doing their job would be important. I think it's important to note that the states can't take the place of the federal government entirely, efforts like this are fantastic and try to sort of limit the harm, but ultimately the federal government with the federal protections will be applied when you're talking about federal projects, and those are things that we're all going to have to pay attention to. So we really need to still pay attention to the Endangered Species Act at the federal level, as well as try to prop up what we can at the state level to protect these critters.
Is there something more you'd like to see in a state law to supplement anything that's lost in the Endangered Species Act?
No, I think that each state has different state protections that are available, and so making the state protections as protective as possible would certainly be a step in the right direction. But again, there are things that are only going to be covered by the federal government. And so there's a lot of things we just can't fix unless we're also fixing them at the federal level.
What kind of species in California would be most at risk if the federal rollback does go through? I mean, this is a proposal. It hasn't actually been passed, as I understand
That's
it.
Right.
So what are environmentalists, biologists, scientists concerned about the most?
I think they're concerned about all of the species, but especially those that have habitat where people are apt to be proposing big projects. And, in California, as well as up here in the Pacific Northwest, salmon and endangered salmon are one of the top issues for protection. So that's talking about, whether you're polluting the waterways, or you're making the waterways are getting warmer because of climate change, or there are dams in the way where they used to spawn. One of the incredible success stories from California is that there are Klamath River salmon, the salmon in the northern part of the state, that are making their way into Oregon rivers to spawn for the first time since the 1900s, because some dams have been removed. But had this rule been repealed before that, those dams might not have been removed, because harm to the habitat, harm to the river, would not have counted as that kind of harm to the fish that need the protection. So it's across the board. Species that rely Species that are on the edge, species that are having a lot of interactions with our human progress are the ones at most at risk.
You know, when the Endangered Species Act was passed in 1973, it had overwhelming bipartisan support. I think there were only four no votes. And this was something that was passed in the era of Richard Nixon. What does it say to you to see the integrity of this law that has been around for more than 50 years to be challenged in this way?
I think it shows the blindness of this administration to the place and the value that the Americans place on their wildlife and on the protection of the natural world and its animals. It was bipartisan in 1973. Every single poll that's been done since then talks about the vast public support for the protection of endangered species, and the law has been the same for decades. It's only when you get really cruel administrations like the one we see today trying to change the regulations, trying to reinterpret settled law, that you get this sort of, I think, what flies in the face of what most people in the United States actually want.
And how will Earth Justice respond if this rule is in fact passed?
Well, you mentioned it's not final. It's not been final. It's a proposed rule. If it is announced as a final rule, we will immediately go to court and sue to stop it. It's illegal. It would violate the spirit, the purpose, and the language of the Endangered Species Act itself. And the chance of it doing harm is just too great to wait. We would be going to court as fast as we could.
Well, thank goodness that the Earth has a law firm. And we'll have to leave it there. That was Kristen Boyles. She's the managing editor with Earth Justice. Kristen, thanks so much for joining us on State of the Bay.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Coming up next after this short break, we'll talk with end-of-life doula Diane Button about her new book, What Matters Most, Lessons the Dying Teach Us About Living. Stay with us.
This week on Bay Made, we are focusing on disability awareness, featuring stories by reporter Chris Agusa, including his series Without a Voice, that looks into allegations of abuse at a home for people with developmental disabilities. So tune in all week at 11:30 a.m. to Bay Made, right here on 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco, Bay Area.
Join KALW tomorrow night at a live event celebrating the Golden State Valkyries and their fans. It's a live recording of Bounce, the Golden State Valkyries' first season in the Bay, at our studio event space. We're bringing together the Bounce reporters and Valks followers for a fan appreciation party reflecting on this historic season, and we're doing it with sponsored food from Joyride Pizza. It's happening at 220 Montgomery Street in downtown San Francisco tomorrow night at 7. Find more info at kalw.org/events.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. For nearly two decades, Diane Button has sat beside people at the end of their lives. She's an end-of-life doula, and in that role, she's listened to their stories, heard about life regrets, and gathered moments of wisdom. It turns out that confronting your mortality can offer you profound clarity. These stories and her journey are at the heart of Button's new book, What Matters Most, Lessons the Dying Teach Us About Living. And she's here with us. Welcome to State of the Bay, Diane.
Thank you for having me today, Grace.
And State of the Bay listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Has your family worked with a death doula? What was that experience like? Or have you cared for a loved one at their death? And what kind of lessons did you take away from that experience? You can join us by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at stateofthebay@klw.org. And you can find us on social media, Blue Sky, Instagram, and more. So, Diane, let's start with the basics for people who may not be familiar with the phrase. What is an end-of-life or death doula?
Well, an end-of-life doula, as I like to call it, is also a death doula. And essentially, we're companions for the dying. I like to call it an end-of-life doula because I look at it as death is just one day, and all the other days are an opportunity for us to live fully. And that's really when we're working with our clients. We're just trying to support them and their families, loved ones, caregivers to have as much peace and comfort surrounding them at the end of life as possible. So we do that through conversations and healing family dynamics and having life review sessions and doing legacy projects, talking about fears, and maybe just having some of those hard conversations that oftentimes people aren't willing to lean into in everyday life.
So this isn't like being a hospice nurse, or you're not offering them medical care so much as you're offering them care to contemplate what the end of their life might be like.
Yeah, it kind of goes along with the title of my book, What Matters Most. We are completely non-medical. So we're there to treat and talk to and spend time with each individual person to find out what matters most to them at the end of their life. And it's amazing how many different ways people show up for the end of their life. And so whatever emotional, physical, spiritual discomfort or issues might be coming up, we show up to talk through those with them.
Do you get involved with that person or that family when the person knows that they're dying, or even before that?
Sometimes people call us before, especially during COVID. We saw this influx of people who just wanted to talk about their mortality, realizing that life can be short, and there was a lot of unexpected death going on during that time. And I think that really shifted the tide for our field, and people did start calling us earlier. Most of the time, people call us when they have a terminal diagnosis, and that's really a wonderful time. If before, it's usually often to talk about advanced directives and some planning. But when someone has a terminal diagnosis, then it's time to get real and have those conversations and think about what matters most to them. So that's the most common time that someone calls us.
I mean, it's probably an interesting, it's a fascinating line of work, and it's probably interesting for people to hear how you got into it. I mean, I think it was with the experience with your grandfather that sort of opened your eyes to this path. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was about did start with my grandfather about 25 years ago when my grandfather died, and he was my hero, and he worked with burn victims. He was a plastic surgeon, and I knew he had experienced so much loss and so much grief, and he was just a very serious man. And when he died, I was holding him in my arms, and he died with this giant smile on his face, the biggest smile I'd ever seen on his face. And it really got me thinking, first of all, how can I die with a smile on my face like that? I just thought it was so beautiful. And, you know, the breeze was blowing and the church bells were ringing, and it was just one of those magical moments. And I started studying about death and dying and existentialism. And I went back and got my master's degree and then started volunteering in hospice and then ended up becoming a death doula, all from really that one experience of holding my grandfather with such a gentle and peaceful death.
You've mentioned going back to school, but what other training do you need or did you obtain to become a death doula?
Yeah, there's really two answers for that. One is that no training is required in a certain sense, because I think of us going back centuries, that's what we did. We showed up for our families and we were all death doulas, and people died in the homes and there were generations together. And I think we all do rise up and take care of each other and act like death doulas when we need to with our own families. However, if you want to do it as a profession, there are training programs out there now. We have a national organization called the National End of Life Doula Alliance, and that organization has a list of training programs and a list of doulas. If anybody's looking for a doula, it has a list of doulas in our area. I am an instructor at the University of Vermont through their doula certificate program, but there are several others around the country now as well. So I definitely recommend someone taking a program. And part of it is to learn how to do the work, but part of it is also to do your own work so that you can be prepared stepping into these sometimes emotional situations.
Well, tell me about the first time you did this work and what you experienced and took away from that.
Well, the first time I did this work, I was very, very nervous, and I sat in the car and just got very sweaty and just
I think we can all relate to that. Yeah.
Yeah.
This does not sound easy.
No. I was just all of a sudden it struck me like, oh my gosh, what can I say? How am I going to show up? And I had a little panic there for a while. But I made it through it. And I just realized at that moment that in order to show up, I really needed to not have an agenda and not worry about what I was going to say and not have it all planned out, but just to really show up with my heart. And yes, I have my doula skills and my doula tools, but it's really about being present. And so, you know, I started that day, I just took a deep breath and I said a little prayer and got rid of all my own worries and cares. And I knocked on the door and I got through it. And it's kind of how I knock on the door every single time. I just try to let go of everything that's going on in my own life so that I can be 100% present when I step in every single time.
Well, a listener writes, when someone we love is dying, it's so hard to know what to do or say. I'm sure everyone is different. But what general suggestions do you have for supporting a loved one who is dying? And I guess, I mean, more particularly, I do think it's so hard to know what to say when somebody has a terminal diagnosis or just even is ill and you don't know what the outcome is going to be. I mean, what is the right thing to say to somebody like that or a loved one of a person who is ill or suffering in this way?
Yeah, that's such a difficult question. And all the circumstances are different. And of course, every single person is different. But one of the things is that we have to remember that when somebody is terminal, then we're not going in and trying to fix a solution, create a solution. We can't fix this problem. This person is dying. So we need to show up and meet them where they are. If they're angry, I get it. Let's show up and let's talk about your anger. I always think that asking a person why they're feeling a certain way really opens the door for conversations. But really, one of the things I've learned for loved ones and family members and people coming to visit someone or spend time with someone who's sick is that people don't like to talk about it all the time. Imagine you get a terminal diagnosis and then one person after another comes to visit you. And every single person wants to know what happened, you know, what your treatment is like right now, what's the prognosis. And it gets a little bit tiring for the clients. So I recommend that my clients let people know, hey, I don't want to talk about cancer. I want to talk about you. I want to share some memories. I want to share some stories from our life together. Because that's really what people are thinking about at the end of life. They're not wanting to just wallow in their cancer or their diagnosis all the time. So I think when you bring something to them, a story or a memory or something that's joyful, that's really helpful. And just always remember to ask people what they want. Even when it comes to, you know, helping somebody with something, when somebody's sick, they start losing oftentimes a lot of their autonomy. And that can be really hard for people who are independent and used to living life on their own terms. So before you rush out and get groceries or change somebody's sheets or, you know, clean somebody's kitchen, ask them. Just always remember to ask first. And I think that goes a long way in showing respect for people at the end of life.
No, that's such good advice. Well, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm your host, Grace Wan. We're talking about what it means to live well and die well with end-of-life doula Diane Button. She's the author of What Matters Most, Lessons the Dying Teach Us About Living. And we'd love to hear from you. Have you helped a loved one through their final days or worked with an end-of-life doula yourself? What did you learn? Or do you have questions about how to talk with a loved one about death and dying? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. You know, when we're talking about the end of life, Diane, often we, you know, the dream is that you can have a peaceful ending, that you die in your sleep or in bed or at home. But oftentimes it isn't that way. I mean, death can be both messy and noisy and hard. And I would imagine that sometimes even your clients are angry. When you have a client who is really just upset about dying, what is your approach to that?
Well, like I said before, I really want to meet people exactly where they are. I get it. Whatever emotion shows up in the room, I want to be there to honor and respect that emotion for that particular person. A lot of times I'll want to get to the underpinning of maybe why someone is angry, because perhaps they're angry because they are losing their autonomy, or maybe they're angry because they didn't get to do certain things in their life, or maybe they're holding on to unfinished business. So if I can find the reason behind a certain emotion that's percolating in my clients, then I have a really good opportunity to dig in with them and see if we can shift the tide a little bit so that they don't stay angry all the way till the end of their life. And the truth is, we can't always do that. I mean, some people live a certain way and they die a certain way, and it's impossible to shift. I have to say that usually the people who call a death doula or an end-of-life doula are the people who do want to talk about it. So we're, in a way, we have a little bit of an advantage just with the clients that we work with, because usually they are reaching out so that they do have someone they can process these things with so they don't die a messy death like that in that way.
Well, Rick in Citrus Heights writes, while I am too frightened and too young to think about the end of my life, I would ask that when I die, people only have positive things to say about me, which is something that I think we all aspire to. But that is part of your book. I mean, each chapter ends with sort of a lesson to take away from each person's experience that you write about. And one of those experiences or one of those lessons is to kind of try to live in the present moment with the idea that to do your best by the people around you.
Right. And I love that comment about I just want people to have positive things to say about me, and the fact that you're young, because this is the time to start. I mean, one of the things that we have to remember is that we're building our legacy every single day. All the words we say, our actions, the things that we do are all forming our legacy. So someday at the end of your life, you might ask yourself these questions. You know, will people remember me? What are people going to say about me? How are they going to describe me? What stories are they going to tell about me? And these are the things that we can work on now. You know, even just the simplest things like being kind and showing up and being available for people when they're hurting. I think the things that we do today are really creating our legacy that is going to make a difference when we get to the end of our lives. And I see it a lot with people at the end of their lives who have not healed broken relationships when possible and made the phone calls and said thank you and I'm sorry and all those important things during the course of their life. Oftentimes it's too late at the end, and then that becomes such an urgent part of their end of life. And I think being young and contemplating this now allows us to start doing the work so that we kind of have a clean slate all the time, because you really don't know. You really don't know how long you're going to be alive.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the old hacksaw phrase is you can't take it with you, which, you know, refers to the things that we have around us, all the stuff. And I wonder, in your practice, have you found that to be true? Have you found that people who are dying, they're not focused on the material things that they've acquired in life so much as the people and the feelings and the love?
Absolutely. There's two thoughts that pop into my head when you said that. First of all, the stuff is usually one of the biggest hassles at the end of life. It's crazy. People have garages and storage facilities and lockers and car trunks, and they have stuff everywhere. And sometimes that really becomes a burden at the end of life, just this lifetime of accumulating. I've had clients who have stuff from their parents and their parents' parents that they still haven't gone through. I mean, it just can be a lot. So the material possessions, yes, if you can kind of keep a light load during your life, I think that makes it a lot easier at the end. But truly, at the end of your life, that stuff is irrelevant. Nobody says at the end of life, I love my car, I love my house, I love this award hanging on my wall. Nobody says that.
Yeah, you know? Give me that piece of lucite. I need that, right?
Yeah,
I need
exactly.
to clutch that.
That never happens. It's amazing. No, but people are saying, you know, I'm really all about the people I love and the simple moments of an ordinary day. And when you peel away all the crazy, busy lives that we're living and all the things that we're out doing every day, and you think about the end of your life, or you think about a terminal diagnosis that kind of stops you in your tracks, you realize that what's most important are the simple pleasures of an ordinary day, like that cup of coffee that you have every single morning, or that walk that you take every single afternoon, or that phone call you make every now and then to somebody you care about. That is what matters most, and all the other stuff just kind of goes away.
A listener writes, sometimes families don't agree about what's best at the end of life. How do you help family members come together at the end of someone's life, you know, to help them forget or reconcile their differences?
Yeah, a lot of times we will have family meetings and we'll bring everybody together. A lot of times families do disagree, and if they disagree on something to do with the client, my client, who's the person who's dying, in my mind, that person takes priority for me. I mean, I'm always there for my client. So I'm going to listen and take everything in and try to do my best to create a healing environment. But at the end of the day, if my client says, I don't want that person in the room when I die, then that person, you know, we'll all do our best to keep that person out of the room. Or, you know, I don't want to call and forgive mom, even though I haven't talked to her for 20 years. If all the other siblings are telling that client to call, I'm not going to try to push my client to call because I want my client to be peaceful. So that's really the central piece of all the conversations I have with families. But doing these types of conversations that seem like an intervention, but they're really just a hard conversation, is a real normal part of our work. And it's a real beautiful and profound part of our work. And a lot of healing can take place up until even hours before someone dies, which is just beautiful. You know, you can't ever say somebody can't change because people can change up until right before they die.
You mentioned legacy projects as part of your work, and I wonder, what is that and why is that important?
Legacy projects are important for a couple of reasons. Number one, oftentimes a client who does a legacy project starts feeling meaningful and purposeful about the time they have left. If they want to plant a vegetable garden or they want to do some photo albums or record some videos, or they want to do something that they're going to leave for their loved ones, it's a really beautiful and joyful part of the end of life experience for our clients. And also it's something that they're going to leave behind for the people, you know, who they love. Mm-hmm. So it's really a win-win. It's one of my favorite parts of the work. I've had many clients who we've done legacy work that just shifts how they experience the end of life. For example, we had one client who wanted to have her memorial all about stories and such. But then one day after a conversation, she realized, wait, I want to hear those stories before I die. And so we had all of her friends send cards and letters and just stories that she could hear every single night before she died. And that was beautiful because there was then this legacy project of all these cards and letters that were sent to her that her family got to keep. And she got to hear it all before she died and realized that she'd left a beautiful legacy. So just, you get to know people and then you see what their sparks are and what brings them just joy and gets their passion going. And you can build a legacy project for anyone just knowing that.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, we have Anne from El Cerrito on the line. Anne, welcome to State of the Bay. Here we go. Hold on. I think we just have her. Hi, Anne. Welcome to State of the Bay.
Yes, I've lost both parents, one in 2013 and one in 2018. And although hospice was great, and they provided us with all the paperwork and said everything that they should say about being aware and this is it, I didn't pay any attention to that. I paid attention to, I have to apply this drug and do this thing and do that procedure and make sure this happens. So really, when they died, it was a shock to me. And I feel quite ignorant to have had that happen. But I was so busy trying to do everything and take care of them as one does and they had and we do, that I kind of missed the whole part about this is it. This is the last hour, the last day. And then the other thing was that one of the hospice places tried a new drug, which ended up with my father flailing at us when he died. So he was flailing. And that was totally horrible, of course, as an ending. You want people to go gently into that goodbye and good night. So anyhow, I just wanted to call in because this was hard. I felt ignorant, foolish. I should have been more knowledgeable. I should have understood better, that I should have been more in the moment, as your doula is saying.
Well, Anne, I'm so sorry for your loss, but it sounds like you did a wonderful job being a wonderful daughter to your parents. And, you know, it really does seem that you were quite attendant to them. And Diane, I wonder, you know, to address Anne's concerns about the, at that moment when your loved one is sick, you're trying to keep them comfortable and alive to the best of your ability, but you may miss out on things. What do you say to a situation like that?
Yeah, it's really one of those things that's hard to look back on and feel like you missed some of the moments. I hope that you can give yourself some grace, Anne, and realize that you did the very, very best you could with the circumstances, because those are difficult circumstances, especially when somebody's flailing and having a really uncomfortable end-of-life experience. And so, you know, it wasn't feasible for you to pause and get in that moment. I will say, a lot of times when there is an end-of-life doula involved, you do have more time to pause. And that's, I think, why we're becoming more and more popular and people are calling us more, because you had to do the hardest job in the world, which is caregiving. That is such a hard job, while also trying to be a daughter. And that's really unfortunate, and it happens all the time, that the caregiver role becomes so predominant that you miss out on the ability to be the daughter. And I'm really sorry that you experienced that. I know it can be really hard at times, and hospice is wonderful, but they can't be there 24/7. So really the idea of bringing in support as much as you can really help a lot. But I just hope you can know that you did do the best you could and just not be hard on yourself, because that's a tough situation.
Yeah, Anne, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yeah, Diane, going off of what Anne said, and a lot of times when people bring you in, there's time. They maybe know that they're dying, or they're in preparation for their deaths. But many people die unexpectedly, suddenly. You know, no day is guaranteed. In those situations, is there a role for an end-of-life doula? I mean, it almost seems like that's what your book is about.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody loses someone suddenly, then it's a different kind of a role for us. Obviously, we're not going to be working with a client who's dying, but we can lean into grief and we can process some of those emotions that are coming up for the people that are left behind. And certainly that's a big part of our work. And there's a lot of doulas here in the Bay Area, especially, who do memorial planning as well. And so it's really helpful sometimes to sit with someone and just reminisce and share stories. And, you know, when someone dies suddenly, a lot of times people are too afraid to show up for that person when they need it most. And so to be able to reach out to somebody like us who isn't afraid of that kind of a conversation can be really helpful.
Mm. And what form or what role does spirituality play in your work? I mean, do you key off of the beliefs of the person who is dying or the family, or do you bring something to that equation?
I never bring anything to that equation. I feel that's my client's personal relationship with whatever they choose to believe. So my role is to just support them. And I like to make sure that people have thought about their spiritual belief or a spiritual practice, even if they're atheist or agnostic. It doesn't matter to me what a person's spiritual belief system is. It just matters to me that they've thought about it. Because a lot of times when all the other things start stripping away and people start going inward, which is what happens as death draws near, people stop talking and you could really feel them going inward. It can be really agitating when fears come up around spirituality. So I think it's really important for people to at least acknowledge to themselves what they believe if they're not outwardly practicing a spiritual practice, just so that it can help bring peace at the end of life. But it's not my job to ever change anybody. I just meet people exactly where they are.
Hmm. Well, you know, a lot about this book, but this book is lovely because it's not just about the stories of people dying. It's about what you can learn from them to live a better life. And you have something called a final checklist, which sounds like, you know, a checklist that you go through as you are dying. But really, it's kind of a mantra of questions to think about as you live. And I wondered if we could go through those and you could tell us what's on the checklist.
Sure. I'll first let you know, the reason I have that checklist is because way back when I first started out, I'd show up with a clipboard filled with maybe 100 questions. And I started realizing That's the last thing that these people want. They've got enough medical people coming in and ask them all the questions. So I wanted to just be more personal. So I started diluting the questions, throwing them away, combining them. And I ended up with 6 questions that I try to ask all my clients, usually not in order or anything like that, but usually almost at every single session. But if I know the answer, I don't have to ask it over and over, but I'll tell you what they are. I always want to know who matters most. Who is the person's support system? Who do they want to have with them when they die? The relationships are so important. What matters most? What are the things in this person's life that they might be working on or feeling like they're really excited about still? And then what is left unsaid? And that's a lot of times about the words, thank you, I'm sorry, I forgive you, do you forgive me? I love you. You know, what is left unsaid? Who is someone maybe from years back that you haven't reached out to that's kind of tugging at your heart that you need to call? And then the fourth question is, what is left undone? And that is, again, about a different kind of unfinished business, more tangible things like that storage facility that never got emptied. And then my favorite question, and my question that I would ask everybody if I could only ask one question, and that is, what do you worry about when you're laying awake in bed at night? Because if I know what you're worrying about, then I know where to start to support you. I don't have to ask you if you're sleeping, eating, in pain, or if you're worried about a relationship or finances or your storage or all the many things that people are worrying about at the end of life. I just ask, what are you worrying about? And that's the question that really gets us going in some deep conversations. And then the final question, equally important, is what brings you joy every day? Because everyone's still alive until their very last day. And so what I'll do is I'll want to know what brings them joy and who their people are. And then I start to get to know my clients and I realize what time of day is the best day for them. And I'll try to match their visits with people and the projects that they're working on and the things that bring them joy with those hours of the day that they feel best. And it just seems to really work seamlessly that way.
Mm. Well, with the minute we have left, I mean, is there a story of a death, a good death, that you'd want to share with our listeners?
Mm-hmm. This one woman named Mari was dying and she hadn't woken up or spoken for a couple days. And I was around the bedside with her husband, 2 children and her sister. And she was just, I thought she was going to die really soon. And all of a sudden she opened her eyes and she looked at her husband, big wide eyes. And she said, thank you for being the love of my life. And she looked at her daughter. Thank you for being the sweetest daughter I could ever have imagined. I love you. And then she looked at her son. I'm so proud of you. Thank you for being in my life and being so kind and compassionate. And I'm getting choked up, of course, because this is just so beautiful. And she looks at her sister. She says, thank you for being the most amazing big sister I could ever ask for. You've taken care of me my whole life. And then I'm about ready to cry. And she looks over at me and she says, thank you for being my friend. And I was just, oh my gosh, my heart just cracked open. But it really taught me a lesson. And the lesson is, not to just say thank you as a passing sentence. You know, pause when you want to say thank you to somebody and look them in the eye and say, thank you for bagging my groceries. Thank you for putting my luggage in the overhead bin. I really appreciate it. Just taught me how to say thank you in a more present and complete way. And I just thought that was one of the most beautiful little simple snippets of a lesson I ever had.
Well, it's both profound and so simple. We've been talking to Diane Button. She's the end-of-life doula and the author of the new book, What Matters Most, Lessons the Dying Teach Us About Living. Thank you so much for being with us here tonight, Diane.
Thanks for having me.
You've given us a lot to think about. Coming up after the break, poet Thea Matthews on her new collection, Grime. Stay with us.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. We'll explore the complexities of making Black horror movies.
It cheapens the experience and re-traumatizes the people who were initially harmed. I don't think that has to happen every time you make a film that explores trauma. I think in America, it happens a lot.
Creating films that draw from real-life horrors. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Hey, this is One Way Possible, your vibe curator and selector. It's Monday, and tonight I will be with you from 8 to 10 p.m. So join me and catch a vibe right here on KALW 91.7 FM and KALW.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ann Harper. Thea Matthews is a poet, educator, and activist who was born and raised in San Francisco. She recently published her second book of poetry, Grime, praised for its precision, fearlessness, and lyrical depth. Grime bears witness to the city that shaped her, exploring race, class, survival, and resilience. We're so happy to have Thea here tonight to talk about her new collection. Thea Matthews, welcome to State of the Bay.
Woo, thank you. Hi, Ann. That's a wonderful intro.
It's wonderful to have you here. So tell us about the title. The title feels kind of raw, kind of haunting. In the poem of the same name, you do write about a young boy on the A train, desperate to escape the grim grime. Can you talk about what that image and that word mean to you?
Yeah, sure. Real quick, that word activist. I mean, I'm a poet first and foremost, and that word is so loaded because I think any artist would be an activist by default to some extent, right? It's like, do we activate through our words? Do we activate through the imagery and all of what we conjure, right? And when looking specifically at the title, Grime, I mean, I'm from San Francisco. And the grime, it's somewhat like the underbelly of the city. It's like within the word, there's grim. And so there's like bleakness, but it's not so much full of despair. There's also, I feel like, a fight for survival within the title. And that's what really that image with the boy, because it's heartbreaking. I saw this kid during school hours where other children are at school in a classroom with resources and are having different childhood experiences. I'm observing firsthand and literally this boy having to hustle, go from car to car with expired candy. And asking strangers to help. And so, yeah, it's like, that's our glorious city, you know, where dreams come true. So there's another angle, you know.
And that juxtaposition, it sounds like. So when you spoke with KALW after your first poetry collection came out, you described it as exploring survival, resilience, especially triumph over trauma and the alchemy of healing. Would you say that their themes are similar in Grime?
Great question. You know, because I think I'll be writing about that till my last breath, honestly. However, what has changed dramatically, and I purposely use the word dramatically because I have fallen madly in love with dramatic monologues and the access and the vehicle form provides, where it's an extension of survival. Like, yes, writing about resiliency, the human condition. Now I'm looking for other ways in which to embody the poem or to have a poem participate on a discourse, whether it be gentrification or gun culture or systemic violence or familial violence.
Yeah. Well, let's have you read one of the poems from this collection. There's one called Revolution is the Hope of the Hopeless.
Yes, we'd love to. Revolution is the hope of the hopeless. Says a piece of painted plywood in white on a wall of an old, empty family rec spot on Turk and Fillmore, the one-time Black Harlem of the West, where jazz once echoed on swings and blues once cooed on rooftops, where slick shoes and permed hair charted their steps to freedom. Boys would later skip school, laugh bullets, clock paper, and girls would do their braids by passenger side mirrors, together, jump rope in front of a police station, paint the sidewalk black, holler with blunts on the corner of what is now the Western Addition, Alamo Square, where crack robs a home and tourist bags are stolen, where transplants eclipse Black families. With each step, my hands want to chip paint off the wall until I see light glowing in the wood grain. Revolution begins at rock bottom.
Can you talk about what inspired this piece for you and what it means to write about San Francisco in this way?
Yeah. You know, there's that movie, The Last Black Man in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And there's that famous scene where it's like, you don't get to hate the city until you love it. And I think, oh, it's emotional. I mean, it's my hometown. I love the city.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like in many ways, it's like, oh, my heart's broken. You know, it's like there's a lot of heartache to see just how, I don't want to use like a loaded term like ethnic cleansing, but just like how like the Black population, for instance, has plummeted, you know, or the risk of survival crimes to have escalated to unprecedented levels where, yeah, there's a threat to just safety. And it's juxtaposed where like everything's fine, you know, all these waves of transplants coming in and in awe of San Francisco. And you're like, wait, do you see what I see? And I've witnessed all of it.
I mean, you're in New York now, right?
I'm in New York. Oh, I'm from San Francisco. I go back and forth. So I'm out there like at least twice a year. And then 2023, my friend was sick. So I was out there like six times.
Yeah. Obviously, the neighborhoods have changed over time, the Fillmore especially. And the pandemic was definitely a rough patch for San Francisco. I'm wondering if you've seen any improvements in the last year.
I mean, what I deeply admire always is just the unconditional love and pride San Franciscans have. You know, like the Giants, the SF, the 415, that is prominent. And I think the hunkering down of like, we are here to stay. And those pockets of art, right? Because there is communities, you know, mm-hmm. that are flourishing, that exist, you know, that are holding down the fort, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear another poem from your collection. How about The Last Night?
I'm asking you to touch me, to give me a hand, to lift me up and hold me as porcelain, as something dangerous. Hold nothing back as if you're spitting out the pit of a plum. The room is the same as before you slept with that man, as maple leaves flitter off their branches. I can't share you like I told you I could. The red-tailed hawk is ravenous, low flying for its next catch, and finds a yearling crow to snatch. I'm hungry. Enough with dissension, with cutting off by Burnham's, enough with smashing bone on asphalt to watch headwater lead back to an endless ocean. Where is the wind you promised me? You convinced me you were more than what I thought was possible, more than the sediment of crushed seashells, more than the coral found in sunset. I leave faster than you ever thought I could.
There's such longing and vulnerability. And yet it's self-assertion and a decision to leave there. It struck me as a real emotional shift. Can you talk about what this poem meant to you?
Yeah, I was definitely leaning into the urban geography, I guess, or urban like wildlife. You know, I love hawks. They're in the city. Just the nature and the ocean, and then just like juxtaposing that with yearning. And I mean, this poem, The Last Night, is literally the last night and end of a relationship, and the vulnerability and honesty within oneself.
You have a poem, his name is Sam, where you talk about meeting this young man who's struggling with addiction. And after tracing his daily cycle of survival and despair, you look into his eyes and tell him, you are loved. You deserve to live, to have this pure connection, this swath of unconditional love, this reverence for life. Come home, Sam, come home. It feels deeply empathetic, but at the same time, confronting pretty hard truths. How do you find space for hope in these times? Does poetry help you get there?
Yeah, and I hope Sam is alive. I met him outside, like right by the Bose Triangle, like close to Church and Market. It was one of those moments, like if I close my eyes, I remember his face. I felt so compelled to immortalize him, I guess, like put in a poem, you know, capture that whole scene and moment in time and just lock it in. And the hope is that, I mean, as someone in recovery, I know there's a solution, you know, and so I'm not plagued by, oh, this is doomsday. No, if anything, this could just be someone's bottom. Like everyone needs to hit rock bottom before they rise and have the, you know, Phoenix ashes rising moment, you know. And I'll never forget this. A fellow told me a breakdown can be a breakthrough. So even with writing a breakdown, seemingly a breakdown of the spirit, the breakdown of one's mind, of committing an act where you're like, this is heinous, it can lead to a breakthrough where then that can launch us into change.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, but we've been talking to the poet Thea Matthews. Her new collection of poems is entitled Grime. It's available in bookstores now. I encourage you to read it. It's a really beautiful body of work. Thank you so much for joining us, Thea.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much, Erin.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We want to thank all our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation. Next Monday at 6, we'll unpack FAFO parenting. Tune in to learn what happens when kids, quote, find out. That's the new name for an old idea, letting kids learn from their mistakes. Tonight's show is produced by Ann Harper and hosted by her, Kendra Klang and Chris Nooney. The last segment was introduced and engineered by Devin Strolovich, and D Minor was our board operator. Coming up next, an episode of the Your Call series, The Authoritarian Playbook. I'm Grace Wan. Good night. Thanks for listening.